News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on News Talk 580 KMJ. You hear us on the AM side at 1 o'clock. You can catch it on FM 105.9 at 5 o'clock at any time at kmjnow.com. If you've heard the show before, you know that we visit each week with World War II veterans. We want to honor them for their service, for the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories for posterity and along the way learn a thing or two about what it means to really love your country. We call it Hometown Heroes, not because anyone's looking for glory or claiming to be heroes, but because no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or small your hometown might be, chances are there are some people in your neighborhood that have done a whole lot more than you think to preserve the freedom we know in this country. And one of those gentlemen joins us today from Cayucas on the Central Coast. Bob Gross, going to be 90 years old in November, but I want to take you back to some earlier days, Bob. You graduated from Roosevelt High School in Fresno in 1941, and by December of that year, just about everybody I've talked to had their world rocked a little bit on December 7th, 1941. Where were you, and what do you remember about hearing the news of Pearl Harbor?
I was at home and had the radio on, I believe, and they interrupted the program to announce that Pearl Harbor had been bombed, and that was an awakening to me.
Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
I'd heard of it before, but it wasn't a reality until you heard what had happened.
And at this point, you're just starting college at Fresno State. What were you thinking your life was going to be like? What were you aiming to do with yourself?
Well, I wasn't really sure what I was aiming to do. I wanted to get an education, but I knew that things were going to certainly be changed, and changed rather rapidly.
And how quickly did they change for you? You decided the Naval Reserve was a good spot to start?
Yes. I tried to get in the Navy Air Corps, but that didn't work, and as it turned out, it was probably a blessing, but I did get in the Naval Reserves, and we went into a unit in Fresno.
And, you know, I get a kick out of over the years having some Navy veterans of World War II tell me the great seagoing destinations they were sent to, places like Farragut, Idaho, or in your case, Dickinson, North Dakota. A lot of water around there?
Yes, a little river that ran down through the town or by the side of the town. That was the extent of the water.
So you were destined to be an officer in the U.S. Navy.
What? Yeah.
How did you feel about that? Was that exciting to have the chance to go to officer candidate school and think that you'd be in a position to do what you wanted to do?
Yes. It gave us something to look forward to, and with some expectation and yet some doubts and some concerns and I guess even a few chills of when you thought about it. But yes, it was excellent opportunity.
Now, you'd been through the wars on the gridiron and the little big game, what they call now the pig game, with Fresno and Roosevelt going head-to-head. Something tells me the Navy put you through a few things that would make you tougher than a football player. Is that fair to say?
I think that's true, yes, yes.
Do you remember a moment where you said, wow, this is tough stuff. I don't know if I'm cut out for this.
I've always had a rather optimistic outlook. I don't think that maybe I was too young to be really scared and I thought that things would work out, but and as they did, for many it didn't, and that was the real tragedy.
So how did things unfold for you? I know somewhere along the line where the Navy sent you, you met a young woman that you decided to marry, right?
Yes, yes.
Tell me about that.
I had met her at Fresno State, and her name was Emlyn View, and we were married. When I got commissioned, the same day I got commissioned in Plattsburgh, New York, we were married that day, and we had a couple of months before I was given orders to ship out on a ship returning from Europe.
And was this the LST 620?
That's correct. It had come back. It had been over in the invasion of Normandy and was coming back to the States, and I had been scheduled for another ship, and I got orders to await the 620 and be an officer on that ship.
And I've read a few of your adventures as an officer on that ship, and we're going to hear some about some close calls and also some hilarious hijinks that you guys were up to on that LST. But I've got to ask you, to get orders to go overseas and know that you're leaving behind this young lady you just married, what was your mindset? Did you, you said you're an optimistic guy. I guess you believed you were going to see her again someday, huh?
No, I was pretty sure of that, but and I was lucky that it turned out that way. But it was tough leaving someone that you had just married, and things were going well, and yet we got to travel a little bit together, went down to Norfolk, Virginia, and spent some time there 3 or 4 months before I shipped out.
And then you ship out.
Yeah.
Did you know yet that she was expecting when you shipped out?
No.
When did you find that out, that you were going to be a father?
Yeah. Well, we went through the canal and came back up to San Diego, and I knew at that time that I was going to be a father.
What did that do to you? Already you're worried about making it back for your wife, and now there's a kid that's probably going to be born before you ever have a chance to meet him or her.
Well, it's not easy, but when you're young, you can go through a lot of things.
Well, and clearly you did. And so this was late 1944 by the time you ship out?
Yes. I shipped out on, left San Diego on, I think it was about December 23rd or something like that, just before Christmas.
Yeah, that had to be a pretty memorable Christmas for you.
Yes, yes.
What was life aboard that ship like? And for people who've never been on an LST, you hear a lot about, you know, aircraft carriers and battleships and destroyers. And I think your average person, when you say LST, they have no idea if that's a big ship, a little ship, and all the things it's capable of. And it sounds like your LST was capable of quite a bit.
Yes, an LST is the largest of the landing ships that could actually go into the beach and lower a ramp and let off troops or tanks. And LST means landing ship tank. And they were about football field length to end zone to end zone. They're about 328 feet long and had a beam of about 50 feet. They were a good ship to be on. One thing about them, they were almost torpedo-proof because they were like a floating bathtub. When they were unloaded, they only drew at the deepest about 7 foot six at the stern. And when they were loaded, they were about 14 feet at the stern. And most torpedoes were shot at about depth of 20 feet or more, so you were fairly safe.
Well, and you had to find that out firsthand, didn't you?
Yes, we found it out several times when we were, a couple times we were attacked by Japanese submarines while we were in flotilla formation. Of course, being on the conning tower, you could see the torpedo going through the water right straight across the whole flotilla, so it was interesting. Fortunately, none of them were hit.
Well, and I guess if they keep sailing below you, you build a little bit of confidence after a while, but that really strikes me as something I'd like to understand what it feels like. When you see that torpedo coming your way, it's headed straight for you, and the moment where it's either going to hit your ship or go underneath you, what do you do in that moment? Are you closing your eyes? Are you crossing your fingers? Are you saying a prayer? What are you doing?
Well, you're saying a prayer, I'll guarantee you that. But I think the most that we've ever had was none that went right under our ship. You'd see them ahead of you. If they were going under the ship, you generally weren't looking at the side where they were coming from. You were looking ahead of where you were going. So you'd see those that would go ahead of you, but not those behind you.
That certainly makes sense. And it wasn't just torpedoes. We're going to talk about kamikazes by the time we're done as well. But give us a sense, Bob, if you can, of your duties on the ship. You're holding the rank of lieutenant at this point?
No, I was an ensign.
You're an ensign, okay.
Yeah, lowest rank of officers.
Uh-huh.
And I was one of the deck officers. The LST had about 8 to 10 officers on board and a crew of anywhere from about 110 to 120 people. It was good duty because you were all about the same age. You knew most everybody on the ship by their first name, whether it was enlisted men or officers. It was very good duty. Our ship was the flagship, had been a flagship in Europe, which means you had a commanding flotilla officer over all of the ships within the flotilla, which was about 36 ships. We had a doctor. We had a dispersing officer for that flotilla. And they stayed on our ship even when we came back to the States. When the ship came back to the States, the flotilla commander, he left the ship with his crew, but the doctor and the paymaster stayed on, so we were always a popular ship when we got, because that meant people were going to get paid.
And I want to get to your day-to-day operations personally, but before I forget, you know, you told us what LST stands for, but I understand really on your first journey as you're heading out toward the Pacific, you found out why some people came up with other words to fill out LST, a large, slow target.
Yeah, they were slow. Our top speed was about 12 knots, which is about 14 miles an hour, and you generally cruised at about 10, so that meant in 24 hours you could go 240 miles. So it was slow going. It was slow going. We had trouble with ours. We'd get in a flotilla or a group that was going to an invasion or something, and they would have a report of a possible submarine in the area or something, and they'd go flank speed, and we'd go flank speed, but we couldn't keep up with the newer ships.
Mm-hmm.
So we oftentimes were straggling way behind.
Well, and the airmen would call that tail end Charlie, but you guys were in the back as a sitting duck for enemy subs, and I understand that there was a time you heard a sub alert, and exactly what you just talked about happened, where the faster LSTs pulled away, you guys were sitting behind, and you are on the conning tower looking back to see a submarine surface?
I was on the conning tower, and I was looking ahead, and I saw the ripple of something up ahead, and I said, oh, that looks like a periscope coming up, and sure enough, but as soon as that periscope broke the water, the American flag went up, and I says, thank you, Lord.
Amen to that. I guess you and I might not be talking if it had a different flag on top of that.
That's very true. Very true.
And that kind of stuff happens, I guess. People just didn't know that the submarines in the area were American, so you guys were spooked pretty good.
Well, we're supposed to be briefed of any operating in the area, but briefings didn't always get down to us.
How did you stay busy on that ship? Was it never-ending duties? Did you have some downtime?
With eight officers, you were always assigned a four-hour watch, and so you knew about every eighth 4 hours you were on duty. It would change to where you were part-time on day duty and part-time on night duty, and you were the one who was running the ship. It was good. Then during the day, you had my job was the deck officer, which were those that kept up the ship, made sure that everything was oiled up on the deck operation, all the shivs and all the machinery that was deck machinery, not the engine room, but just up topside. Then you had to keep the ship painted and the rust chipped off, and you had a crew that you supervised. We had a ship fitter shop that did all the welding and any repair work that needed to be done. So we kept busy. We kept busy throughout the day and busy even at night, of course, when we had duty.
And I want to talk about some of that, but before we take our first break here in a moment, tell us what was the first moment for you that really felt like war, where you got your first taste of, you know what, there's an enemy out there. And that enemy wants to destroy us. When does the first time that really hit you in a real way?
One of the first times is when we were up at Iwo Jima, and this was late in the operation at Iwo Jima, and we had gone in and unloaded some equipment, and then you'd back off, and we'd be out in the away from the shore, but you could look in through the telescope or anything, and you could see these Marines going from cave to cave with a flamethrower, and he really realized that there were people that were losing their life.
And did that make you thankful that you were on the ship and not on the island, or did you say, wow, I could be next? I'm in a pretty dangerous position myself.
I think you felt generally that the other person was in greater danger than you were. Very fortunate to be on the ship, because you knew you were going to have a bed to sleep in and not a foxhole. I felt for the Marines that we had to land and didn't have that opportunity.
Absolutely. We're talking to 89-year-old Bob Gross of Cayucas, California. When we come back, we'll hear a few more of his experiences on LST 620 in the Pacific during World War II. We'll talk about some of those serious moments and some of the lighthearted ones, too, when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, friends, no tea.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 to the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance,
like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too.
Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're visiting this week with 89-year-old Bob Gross, now lives in Cayucas, California. He grew up in Fresno, went to Roosevelt High School, was at Fresno State when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. He ended up in the Navy and spent the latter days of World War II on an LST numbered 620. We're going to hear about some of those stories. If you'd like to see some pictures from Bob's memories of the war, you can check out our website at kmjnow.com. You were talking about Iwo Jima when we left off, Bob, and the battle was winding down there. American forces at a great price had seized control of that island, and of course it would have some strategic importance in terms of the airstrips used there. Did you ever get a chance to get off that LST and get onto those volcanic shores at Iwo Jima and get a taste of what had unfolded there?
Yes, we had the opportunity when we were beached that when there was not work to do, we could go off and do a little scouting around. And I think one of the experiences that we think of the Japanese people as being small, short, and yet one day I was walking and near one of the caves on Iwo Jima, and there was a big man that had been killed, Japanese. And I thought, my golly, I can't believe he's this big. So I laid down beside him, and I was 6'2", and he was every bit as tall as I was. And he was a Japanese Marine, maybe possibly of Mongolian birth, but he was a big one, and I never forgot that.
Was it difficult to look around on Iwo Jima and see the devastation and destruction? Had you been desensitized to it by then, being in the Navy, or just as a human being? What was that like?
Well, if you've been in one of the invasions, the destruction is when they sit there for several days with the battleships out about 5 or 10 miles offshore and lobbing in 16-inch shells. The devastation is terrific before anything is landed in on the beaches, and then the devastation just increases.
And during this time, you're seeing things like this. You're still quite a young man. In your early 20s, you've got a wife back home, you know a child is on the way. Did you get mail from your wife? How often did you hear from back home in Fresno?
Well, being on an LST, travel was so long from place to place, then the mail ship had to find where your ship was. So it took probably about every 30 days. We were fortunate if we got mail once every 30 days. It was a long time in finding out any information from home.
And we'll find out eventually when you finally heard that a child had been born and when you finally got to meet your firstborn. But let's talk some more about this LST-620 and the places you went. Now, did your ship participate in the invasion stage of the Battle of Okinawa?
No. We were a supply ship, and we hauled ammunition from Pearl Harbor, howitzer ammunition, 155 howitzer ammunition from Pearl Harbor to back up the invasion. The invasion took place, and we were probably on the way to Okinawa at the time with the ammunition.
By this time, had you heard the term kamikaze?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. Anytime you were out there, you knew there were kamikazes.
Do you remember what it was like the first time you actually saw them in action and realized that you guys could be their target?
Well, we got up at Okinawa, and about for 20 days, you had raids coming from Tokyo over Okinawa, and they'd go down to Formosa and then come back again. And the raids would generally take place about 8 o'clock at night, and then again at 12, and then again at 2, and then again about 4 in the morning, because they wanted to keep you awake. But the kamikazes were very, very effective in what they did. And, of course, there were always stories that these pilots didn't know how to fly airplanes. But I tell you, they really raised havoc at Okinawa with the ships that were up there. And, of course, again, being on an LST, we certainly weren't the primary targets, because there were battleships, there were cruisers, and there were big ships that were better targets. I can remember one night the kamikazes hit the cruiser Birmingham. I think they took 3 hits, and they were pumping for 3 days trying to keep the Birmingham afloat. They managed to keep it afloat, but that's about all. And they were very effective in keeping us awake, but they were also effective in destroying some ships and killing people.
And you tell that story, and I'm sure you've shared these stories with your children and with others over the years, but I don't hear fear in your voice when you describe that. Did you feel fear at the time with this, like, clockwork attack of kamikazes day in, day out?
I guess sometimes it's almost, you're in it, but it's almost like it's unreal, almost like you're looking at a movie. The planes are coming over, they're flying so high that, and all the fleet is shooting at them, and many of the projectiles wouldn't even travel that high. I don't know. I don't know how to express it. You didn't feel fear, and yet I'm sure there was some fear, but it's not like it would be now if I had to face it.
Do you think it helped to have developed friendships and relationships with some of the guys on your ship, whether they were officers or enlisted men?
Oh, yes. There was great unity on our ship. We were officers, but they were part of the crew, and we were part of the crew. That was one nice thing about being on that type of duty. I can remember being in Norfolk, Virginia, and a young man came over and asked if he could come on board our ship, and I got talking to him. He was an officer, young officer, ensign, just like me. He was on the battleship. I don't even remember which one it was at this time, but he said, well, he had a place on the ship that was, he saw where we had a nice room and bunks and a desk and little, I'd say settee. It was really a built-in couch. He says, oh, mine, he says, is 6x8. And he says, I'm not allowed to talk to anybody in the crew because we're in the officer's country. But ours was very informal, and I think there was always respect between the crew and the officers. We had a great captain on our ship, and he wouldn't stand for any abuse of crew or anything such as that. And it was really good duty. I enjoyed it.
Although I don't know if you enjoyed it when you talked about what your assignment as you headed to Okinawa was. You're carrying ammunition for the 155s, the big, long howitzer guns, and those are some giant shells.
Yeah.
And I guess that makes you a little nervous when you transport stuff that you know is that explosive and that dangerous, especially when the water gets a little rocky, right?
Oh, yeah. I can remember one time we were carrying ammunition, and we hit a storm, and they hadn't quite shored up the ammunition well enough. And, of course, an LST carrying no draft, in other words, nothing underneath down below the surface, you roll back and forth. You don't roll up and down, you roll back and forth. So all of a sudden you'd hear this ammunition, and it got a little loose, and it rolled back one way and then rolled the other way and rolled back the other way. The only nice part about it was that the detonators were stored in lockers that we had, so the shells weren't going to go off just from rolling back and forth, but it was the fact that if the whole cargo really got moving, we could have been in some real trouble. Fortunately, it was not a long storm, but there was scary time because you couldn't get down there and do any shoring up or anything and while the ship was rolling. Too dangerous.
And when you guys got to Okinawa, you said, well, where should we go? How about next to a battleship with a bunch of guns that can defend us from the kamikazes, right?
Oh, yes, yes. We had a captain, and he was a smart man. So we pull in there with our ammunition, and he thought, well, there's the battleship Iowa, and there's Birmingham, and there's another big ship over here. We'll just go anchor in between them. So we pull in, and we dropped anchor, and the first thing we know, we get a signal from the battleship Iowa, and captain of the Iowa asks our captain, what is your cargo? And when he sent ammunition, we got explicit orders to immediately move to the ammunition and fuel anchorage area. So we had to get underway right away and get out of there. They wanted no part of a big boom.
Yeah, they didn't want you guys blowing them up, that's for sure.
That's right. That's right.
I guess you always end up learning your place sooner or later in the Navy.
That's very true. Very true.
Now, before we talk about some of these tricks you guys pulled, and boy, no shortage of mischief on that LST 620, and I know you've even remarked a couple times in your memoirs that you might have been court-martialed if they knew everything you guys did. But on a serious note, when you think back of things like torpedoes and kamikazes, a typhoon that we'll discuss as well, is there one thing that you reflect back on as your closest call?
One night we were underway, and our bow doors, one of the lookouts on the bow was telling us he heard the doors banging, and these were monstrous doors. So we had to find out, well, what's going on? And so this would be one of the duties that would fall in my category. So I went up, and I went down into the area there and found that the doors were loose. And they were held together by great big turnbuckles, and somebody hadn't tightened them tight enough. So we thought, well, we'd go down and tighten them. And the three of us went down, and I didn't want the crew going down, anybody going down that I wasn't going to be a part of. And they just kept getting looser and looser, and it was rough. And we finally, one of the men slipped, and I grabbed him, and he held on, and I held on, and the other guy pulled us back up. That was a scary thing because in one of the previous landings, we'd lost one of the flaps on the door, so the water would swish up through underneath, and it was scary. It was a time when I really wondered, am I going to make it? But we made it.
Well, and it strikes me that maybe there's a parallel to one of the other stories that that I've read about that you experienced when you were thinking about some of the religious beliefs of the guys on your ship, another situation where you were called to battle stations and you had to go on damage control below deck, and you heard some strange noises from the mess hall?
Yes, we had general quarters. We'd been reported that one of the assignments, one of the men that was supposed to be passing ammunition up to the 40 millimeter guns wasn't there, and I had to go down below ship to find out where and who. And as I got near the galley, well, I heard some mumbling going on and looked over, and here was one of my mess stewards who was down on his knees, and I says, Daniel, what are you doing? He says, I'm praying. I said, well, you're supposed to be up passing ammunition. He says, I'm on duty here. He says, I'm praying to the Lord. he was praying. I says, well, have at it, Daniels. Maybe we need that better than they need the ammunition. So it worked. It worked. We made it.
Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition.
Yes, huh? Yes. I think that's where the song came from.
From that, that incident on the LST 620. No doubt. I'm sure it did. Well, we need to take another commercial break. When we come back, we'll hear from Bob about the typhoon that he survived aboard the LST 620 and some of the lighthearted stories from his time in the Navy during World War II. 89-year-old Bob Gross, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on KMJ. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing's selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else.
Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll come down the home stretch now with 89-year-old Bob Gross. He lives now on the coast in Cayucas, California. Great place to visit if you're here in the valley and looking to get out of the heat sometime. Bob faced plenty of heat in World War II in the Navy aboard the LST 620. We've got a lot to cover still, Bob, but I want to hear about this typhoon. This is toward the end of the war. You've already made a few trips back and forth to Okinawa delivering supplies. Was the weather, did it present more fierce opposition than the enemy did?
Yes, in many ways. We were in Okinawa and got called that the typhoon was on the way and told the ships in the harbor to get ready to get underway because they would be safer underway than they would be sitting ducks in the harbor. So we got underway and headed out, and it was rough, starting to get rough. And about 8 o'clock at night, it was turning dark, and there were a number of ships in the area. First thing that happened is our radar went out, and you couldn't see because it was raining so hard that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. So we had to just hope that the other ships' radars were working, and they were staying away from us. Then we got underway, and we tried to form groups of ships that could go out, and we had a commander that took over. Unfortunately, instead of heading out from the typhoon, we headed right into it.
Holy cow.
And we were running at about 1,000 yards from ship to ship, and it got so rough that when the swells would come, you'd drop into the pit, and you couldn't see anything ahead because everything in the water was above you. And then when you went up on the peak of the, you could see forever, but you couldn't see the ship ahead because he was in the trough. So it was a rough occurrence. And after the first day out, we were still heading more and more into the typhoon. And one of the mines that had been dropped by somebody, I don't know whether it was Japanese or what, we looked off at the side, and here was this mine, and it, you'd go up, and it'd roll down, and you'd roll up, and it'd roll down. And we finally got past it and signaled to the next ship and hoped that somebody would blow it up. But as far as I know, it was never blown up. May have been a dud, I don't know, but scary operation.
How close do you think it got to you when it was rolling that way?
Probably 300 feet, something like that. Enough, close enough that you could see it and knew what it was.
Close enough to take your breath away a little
bit,
huh?
Yeah, Yeah, hoping that it didn't roll down when you were down there.
And so this went on for days, and you guys...
We were in the typhoon for about 2.5 days. Then it finally calmed down.
Were you able to sleep at all?
No, you couldn't sleep. You had to brace yourself even to lay down to stay in the bed.
Wow.
Or in your bunk. They were really bunks.
Sure. I could see that rocking your world just a little bit.
Yeah.
And when it finally calmed down, I guess you saw quite a few of the after effects when you got to Okinawa?
Oh, when we came back to Okinawa, Okinawa was a mess. The Fleet Post Office had been completely destroyed, and there was mailbags and junk all over everybody, every place. When we went out, we had a smaller ship, an LCT, on our main deck that we launched at Okinawa. They were used as loading barges. They could come alongside the LST, and you could use a crane to load them up, and then they'd go into the beach. They had been in the harbor when we left, and when we got back to Okinawa, we couldn't find them. They'd been with us for almost a year. Finally, I don't know how it came about, but one of their crew found our ship when we came back, and they had been blown into a meadow that was a good half mile from the harbor. They were high and dry and spent the rest of the war high and dry on an LCT in a meadow. But it was really devastating. They just ships. The one ship was up on the breakwater, a big ship, on the breakwater, high and dry. It was a mess.
And I'm guessing, just for people that are a little younger and they don't have a frame of reference, would you say the visuals that you saw after the big earthquake and tsunami in Japan recently, is that kind of what it looked like at Okinawa back then?
Very similar. I mean, anything that was standing was pretty well damaged. Of course, I wasn't on the land, but they said that there was sheet metal flying from the Quonset huts that would have been blown away, and it was really a mess.
Now, I keep promising that we're going to hear about some of your adventures and misadventures, but I don't want to miss out on having you tell us about a guy who was one of your heroes, because nobody that I ever have on this show will admit to being a hero. No one's looking for attention. No one wants to be bragging about anything. But often I find that veterans are willing to tell us about people they served with that they really saw as heroes. And you have a guy like that who came on your ship that it took you a while to figure out what was going on with him.
Our last trip to Pearl Harbor at the end of the war, we went back to Pearl Harbor to pick up a load of Marines that were going to be in the invasion of Japan. Also, at that time, we picked up a young officer, same age we were, that came on board, and you'd talk to him, and all he would say is yes or no, or he didn't appear to know anything about shipboard, yet you knew he'd been in the Navy for a period of time, and very quiet and a loner. I took him up a couple nights to sit watch with me as we were underway, and you couldn't even get a conversation going. And I told him one night, I said, none of us want to be out here. You don't have to be so quiet about things. And he said, well, you wouldn't understand. And that's about the conversation we'd had at any time in our travels from Pearl Harbor to which was going to be the invasion of Japan. So when the war was over, during the time we were in travel, and we were told to go into one of the lower islands, when MacArthur went in, they organized a couple of little fleets, and we were to go into the southern island. While MacArthur went into Tokyo, we'd go into the southern island. After we'd gone into Japan, Dave came back to the ship one day, and he was bawling like a baby because they had set up a schedule for people to go home, and that was based on the time of duty, how many months you'd been out, what awards you'd received. And Dave came back, and he was just bawling like a baby, and he says, I'm going home, and I'm going home, I'm going home. And I thought, well, he's lost his mind. And later he says, now he says, I can tell you what my problem is. He said, when I went in the Navy, they assigned me to the Scouts and Raiders, and the Scouts and Raiders were really the forerunner of the Navy SEALs. And he'd been sent over into the European theater, and their objective was to find good landing areas. And he was in the unit that went into Italy and went in on several invasions of, they would take them in by destroyer, and they'd drop them off at night in rubber boats. They'd paddle into the shore, and they would scout the areas to good landing areas, checking for underwater obstructions, if they could find any buoys that indicated mines. And then they had to paddle back out to the rendezvous area, and Dave was one of 25 that went in the scouts and raiders in that group, of which 10 came back. He had gone in on several landings when the landings themselves took place. He would go in before any ships would go in, get in on the beach, and they would signal out with a flashlight or to the ships to where they knew where to come in. It just always struck me that Dave was the hero of not only his own life, but he was the hero of our ship. He'd been through much, and he was the only one of the 10 that got back to the States that ever have to be reassigned overseas duty. So I always felt that he had every right to be mad at the world. I've always respected Dave and the courage that he had.
Understandably so, and you put that really well. He was clearly excited to be going home. I bet you were pretty relieved that the war was over, too. Had you found out by now that you were a father?
Oh, yeah. I found out when we went from San Diego down to Guadalcanal and received a telegram that baby arrived troubled. I think that's about what it said.
Well, that doesn't make you feel good.
No, I... no way of communicating. You know, we didn't have a computer that we could flip on and talk to somebody in the States. So about 30 days later, I found out that the wife had a breech birth, and but little boy was born, and things were going well then, and so it was quite a relief. And but there were some days of really questioning whether I still had a wife or whether I had a son.
I cannot imagine what that must have been like. And I also can't imagine what a glorious moment it must have been for you to get home to see your wife again and meet your son now for the first time. What was that like?
Well, you know, it's rather amazing when somebody puts a little boy in your arms and he's about 12 months old and says, "This is your son." And, you know, it wasn't until later that I could experience really a baby is a baby.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a blessing.
And now five sons. How many grandkids you have?
My first wife died, and I've married again, and we have 20 grandchildren together.
Woo-hoo.
And I have six great-grandchildren.
That's a lot of people that are looking up to you and thanking you for what you did in your service to our country. Now, I want to hear a few of these stories. Now, I guess one of the advantages to being aboard an LST as opposed to being on the ground somewhere is if you need to get rid of something, you can just throw it overboard. I didn't know it was that simple, but I guess it kind of was for you guys aboard that ship. This you needed an LCVP replaced, and for people who don't know LCVP, you've seen them in the invasion of D-Day, the Higgins boats, the landing craft that are delivering troops and vehicles to the shore.
Yes.
You had one of these that wasn't working quite right, and they wouldn't give you a replacement?
Well, we had one that had pump trouble and had engine trouble, and we were having a lot of trouble. And one time we went back to Pearl Harbor, and we went into the boat repair section and see if they could do some work on our LCVP, because you couldn't use it, you couldn't trust it. It would work sometimes, but not all the time. So we asked them, they said no, they didn't have time to repair it, and we said, well, we'll give you this one and you can give us a new one. Well, we don't have any new ones. So we went out, and I hope I don't get court-martialed at this late age, but we're out sailing one day and decided, well, the best way to get a new LCVP is get rid of the one that we've got. So we pulled the bottom plug and loosened some of the cables and dumped the thing in the middle of the ocean. And it's still sitting there. And when we got back, we told them that we'd hit a storm and had lost our LCVP. And they gave us a new one, and we were in business again.
So no one thought it was a little fishy that you reported a storm when the seas were calm that day, huh?
No, they were pretty calm because we had a lot of work getting it down and getting it out and getting the people back in and watching it sink.
And that wasn't the only thing that went overboard. I guess at one point some of the crew was complaining about having to chip off rust and paint your LST, and you found a way to fix that too?
Oh, yeah. Yes. People in the Navy, they think you should be working it all the time, and so they give you little chipping hammers, and you could take a regular hammer, but these were metal, and you chipped the rust, and when you got an area cleaned, you red-leaded it and painted it and went on and kept the deck in good shape. So the crew was complaining terribly about having to chip paint, and finally, one day, I got tired of their telling me what to do and complaining, and I said, well, you know, I said, if there weren't any chipping hammers on board, I said, you wouldn't have to chip paint. About 3 days later, the captain said, I don't hear him chipping paint. I said, well, I have to go out and find out what happened. Lo and behold, there were no chipping hammers anymore. They'd all gone overboard, so we didn't chip paint till we got into shore again and could requisition some more shipping hammers.
Oh, an easy solution for some of those problems aboard an LST. And another thing that I was surprised to read and some of the things you've cataloged from your time in the service, you guys weren't dumping these, but apparently there's a whole lot of brand new Jeeps somewhere on the bottom of the sea near the Philippines?
When after the war, we were on a cleanup crew, and they sent us down to the Philippines, and we were going from island to island picking up anything that had wheels on it, and I mean anything. They were categorized into A, B, C, D categories. A, they ran good. They were good vehicles. B, they may have had a wheel missing or something, and on down until you had D, which was you had to even pull them on by a Caterpillar tractor or something to push them in the ship to get them on. And they took them to a docking area or a storage area and placed them in the various categories. We were hauling all these D category things that should have stayed in the jungle. And at the same time, they were bringing in cargo ships. And you could see them offshore. They were unloading something that were in crates. They were going on barges, and instead of coming into the shore, they were going out to sea. And then you'd see the barges coming back from the sea to the cargo ships. We found out they were brand new Jeeps that apparently had been under contract with the companies that they would never be brought back into the United States. And I'm sure off of the area of the Philippines in the little town of Batangas, if somebody went out there, they'd find many crates of brand new Jeeps.
Treasure hunters eat your heart out on
so,
that one.
So when we dumped a broken crane or a broken landing craft, they were doing the same thing after the war.
I understand, too, that you learned a little bit about currency and what might give you a little more bang for your buck. Japanese yen at that point was worthless and blowing all over the ship?
Yeah. Yes. We picked up some Marines that had at Okinawa, taking them back to Pearl Harbor after the Okinawa invasion, and they had gone into the town of Naha, which was the capital of Okinawa, after the invasion. They blew the safe at the Naha Bank, and they had just stacks of Japanese yen, boxes of it, in fact. And they came on board, and they wanted to sell us Japanese yen. Well, we had already knew that there was issued U.S. money that was to be used after the invasion of Japan. It even had some of the invasion money. Nobody wanted the Japanese yen because it was useless. So they would play poker out there with the yen, and when they got through playing poker, they'd leave it there, and we'd take a fire hose, and we'd blow it off the ship while we're underway and clean the deck, and that was fine. When we finally got to Japan, and we had gone into the initial procedure of invasion, and the same day then went on liberty into Japan, nobody wanted any invasion money. They didn't know what it was. Several days later, we found out that the Japanese government wouldn't accept it. They didn't want it. And we found out that the Japanese yen was still the official currency. So I probably could have been a millionaire, but that's been the story of my life. So it wasn't meant to be.
So that's what happened with the yen. But you found out that a few cigars could go a long way for you, huh?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We went on a little leave in Tinian, the island of Tinian. They gave us a little rest duty from activities. I had an uncle that was serving in Guam, which is probably not quite an hour flight from Tinian. So I would go up to the airfield, and they had a commuter service that you could go back and forth. Met the operations officer, and one day I said, you know, I'd like to go up to Guam. And he said, well, you got to come back to the flight at 4 o'clock. And he was really a gruff old guy, and I said, well, I said, you know, I says, don't sweat it so much. I said, well, things aren't as bad as you think they are. He says, you think not? He says, I smoke cigars. And he said, I can't, I just can't get used to cigarettes. And I said, oh, man, I said, you're in bad shape. And so I went back to the ship. I got a box of cigars, and I went up the next day, and I said, you know, I said, I'd like to go to Guam. And he said, I told you the flight leaves at 4 o'clock. And I gave him a box of cigars, and he called a couple of the pilots, and they flew me down to Guam on a B-24, and there was the two pilots and myself. So we were really buddies from then on. All I had to do was go tell him I wanted to get down to Guam, and if there wasn't a flight going out, he'd get me one, because they were all trying to get in some flight hours. But a few cigars worked pretty well.
I guess so. You just had to speak his language.
Yes.
And you mentioned Tinian. Of course, people who know their history know that's where the Enola Gay took off from in August of 1945, dropping the first atomic bomb. Very important B-29 base, Tinian. And you and your buddy thought you might actually get on one of those B-29 bombing runs?
Well, we made some real friends. We were there about, I guess, 15, 20 days in the area, and we met a lot of the pilots. We were looking at things going so slow from invasions from one island to another. And they told us, they said, the war's going to be over in 6 weeks. And they said, well, we've got, we'll take any odds you want that'll be over in 6 weeks. Now, I'm sure they didn't know about the atomic bomb, but believe me, they knew what was happening in the firebombings that were taking place because they were part of it. So we got to go up to a number of their briefings. Of course, in the briefings, they'd show the target area. They would show the secondary target area, and then they would go off and then come back. And after the raid, they would have the final briefing of how did they do. And the devastation in Japan was just unbelievable. The areas that they would make as the primary targets, it'd be nothing but black. They made believers out of us, and there was nobody that would take any of their bets. The war would be over in six weeks. They were very, very much right. So as we met them, I said, well, how about going up one night, and how about flying over Tokyo with you and on one of the raids? Oh, sure, come on. So we went up, got all suited up, and got a parachute, and got on the B-29, and we're all loaded to about ready to take off, and some colonel came on the ship, on the plane. He saw us. He said, who are you? I'm Robert Gross, Lieutenant JG, and he says, get off of this flight. He says, you know, it's not easy explaining why two Navy men didn't come back from the flight. He says, it's hard enough forced to explain why the pilot and the crew didn't come back. So we didn't quite make the trip.
Mm-hmm. Another one of your genius ideas. In that
We were ingenious, all right.
Well, I know we're running out of time, but is there anything else from your time in the service that you want to share with our listeners?
Well, I you know, so many years have gone by that you forget things, and some of them are just well forgotten.
Well, I want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about it. And maybe in closing, you can share with us. I know you were thankful to get home, to meet your son for the first time, to go on and have four more boys, and now you've got this great big family and a lot to be thankful for. I know a lot of people remember you from the time you spent working in the olive industry and with pistachios as well, so maybe a few of your friends are out there listening. Have you ever thought about what you got out of being in the Navy, what it did for you, what you're most thankful for and proud of in terms of being a World War II veteran?
Well, it made me certainly appreciate those that really made sacrifices. My sacrifice was not great. Like everyone else, we served the country as best we could. But my very best friend when we were growing up as kids was killed in the Battle of the Coral Sea. And those are the ones that truly were the heroes. We did our part, whatever we were assigned to do. And I'm just grateful for those that really sacrificed their life that we might have the freedom even we have today.
Amen. I don't think anybody could have put it any better than that. Well, Mr. Gross, thank you very much. Bob Gross of Cayucas, California, has been our guest today. You can read more about him online at kmjnow.com, and we'll be back next Saturday with another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.